Remember where we are in the bigger picture. We're aiming to study general relativity, and we want to go towards cosmology and eventually inflationary cosmology and, you know, the structure in the universe. Where are we now? We now have all the math together to describe space-time in so many different ways. We have lots of mathematical tools. But what we don't have yet is the dynamics of space-time and the dynamics of the matter and radiation fields that live on space-time. So now that we have all the tools together to describe a space-time, today we will study the various equations of motion of matter fields that live in space-time. So this would be fermions, such as all the matter that we are made of, electrons and quarks. And then also electromagnetism, of course, and also scalar fields. We'll do these things today, and then the plan will be that once we have established how the equations of motion look like for matter and radiation in space-time, we then study the energy that couple the energy momentum of matter and radiation to the curvature. A piece of terminology, in cosmology, we don't distinguish between matter and radiation. Even radiation is lumped together with matter. Everything that's not gravitational is considered matter. It's just a terminology. Okay, so here's the plan. First, we study the dynamics of matter and radiation in curved space-time. Then we study the energy-momentum tensor of all of that matter. And once we have that, then we can check how we can then write down the Einstein equation that couples the energy-momentum tensor to curvature. And in this way, we get the Einstein equation. We get the dynamics of space-time itself. So what are the equations of motion for matter fields in a curved space-time? Obviously, we want the whole thing to be covariant, and therefore the equations of motion can only be well-defined, can only be covariant, if the equations of motion are defined independently of any choice of coordinate system. So therefore, the equations of motion have to be equations among tensors and their covariant derivatives. There are a whole lot of different fields in nature, various kinds of fermion fields, various kinds of boson fields. And here's just a small list of them. There's electrons, quarks, gluons, and then pi mesons. These are composite particles made out of two quarks, photons, W bosons, and Z bosons, and so on. It's quite a zoo of them. And one of the big challenges, of course, of physics nowadays is to understand the origin of all of this zoo of elementary particles. In a way, we are at a stage similar to Mendelssohn when the periodic table was first written down. Chemistry looked pretty complicated, but it was clear that there was some systematics to it. And today we have a complicated standard model of particle physics, but we can't derive it yet. And so one of the things that one could say are the deepest problems of physics is understanding where all of these particles come from, why we have these species and not other species. This is, however, not the subject of this course. So instead, we will simply take these families of particles as they are, and we just label them. So our notation is going to be that whatever field it is, whatever fermion or boson field it is, we will write it as some field psi, where the subscript I indicates which species it is. So for some value of I, this would be quarks, a particular kind of quark. For another value of I, this would be a photon or an electron or whatever. So we just won't distinguish them. And then they could have upper and lower indices, contravariant and covariant indices. So our fields could be, in this way, tensors of arbitrary kinds. Now you may wonder, okay, but how about spinners? Spinners are included in here. This is often overlooked, but spinners can actually be represented inside the tensor algebra. I will say a little bit more about this later on. We won't go much into detail about this. We will cover spinners today, but not as deeply as one could. I'll point you to the book by Hawking and Ellis, page 59 onwards. It's super interesting what's happening there. Remember, we studied the Grassmann algebra of differential forms. Differential forms are covariant anti-symmetric tensors. And on top of the tensor product, we introduced the wedge product. And the wedge product was a product that that fulfilled the axioms for a Grassmann algebra. In this way, we got the differential forms. Now, you may wonder, would it be possible to introduce yet another product over the differential forms? That's also covariant and also gives us an interesting structure. And you can do this. And I won't go into detail about this here, but what you obtain is a Clifford algebra. And then, as part of this Clifford algebra, you can identify the spinners. The important overall message here is that spinner spaces are not separate from tensor spaces. They're in there. Okay. So it suffices to look at this index structure here. Okay, so we can describe all kinds of fields in this way. Simple notation. Now you may wonder, okay, so we allow any kind of boson field and any kind of fermion field on our space-time. There could be one more field. And that would be a second gravity. You see, we have the affine connection. And it would be conceivable that we had a second affine connection, that there's not just one gravitational force, but there's another one too, that may be much, much weaker. We didn't know about it because it's so weak, but it may be there. Could that be? You see, let's just get this out of the way before we start studying all of the matter fields, matter under radiation. So yes, in principle, we could. It could be that nature has a second gravity. Another affine connection. However, as we will see now, that is exactly the same as if we didn't have a second gravity, as if we didn't have a second affine connection, and instead we simply had another tensor field, and therefore another force of the usual kind. How do we see that? So the claim is that if we have one gravity, one affine connection, and we have another affine connection, let's call it gamma tilde. And the claim is that the difference between the two is actually a tensor field. And therefore, just one of these ordinary fields that you could describe as matter or radiation that lives on the space-time. Let's see how that works. So we write down the first Christoffel symbol, and we do a change of coordinates. As we do, this is the transformation law. And remember, the nature of this transformation law tells us that the Christoffel symbol is not tensorial. That's why it was a non-trivial question whether a second gravity could also exist. You see, we were only looking at all the tensor fields. The psi were all possible tensor fields. Now, there could also be a non-tensor field, an additional force, an additional field, a non-tensor field, a second affine connection. Then the second affine connection would also transform in this way. And remember, the offending term that makes the Christoffel symbols non-tensorial is this term. This term is not even proportional to the Christoffel symbol. So it's definitely not part of the transformation laws of a tensor, because the tensor always transforms under coordinate changes by multiplying Jacobian matrices. If you always choose your bases and attention spaces along with the coordinate system, which is what we do now for convenience. Later, we will free ourselves from that again. OK, so if we have a Christoffel symbol, if we have an affine connection and it transforms like this, and the second Christoffel symbol that transforms like that, well, then the difference between the two transforms like this. You see, this offending term here that made the Christoffel symbols non-tensorial is exactly the same for both affine connections. And therefore, the difference between the two doesn't contain that offending term. And therefore, the difference between two affine connections actually transforms tensorially. The difference between two affine connections is a tensor. And therefore, having a second gravity is exactly the same as having another radiation field around. So we don't need to consider that separately. It's subsumed in having these psi, this tensorial psis. Now this finding is important not only because it tells us that we don't have to look at second gravities, but also because this tells us that any change in the Christoffel symbol, if we vary the Christoffel symbol, so you see the change of Christoffel symbol is the difference between Christoffel symbol now and Christoffel symbol later, or Christoffel symbol this value for parameter, Christoffel symbol that value for parameter. These differences are tensorial. So if you have a Christoffel symbol and you differentiate it, or you take a difference, or you vary it, that variation, let's write it for now symbolically as delta, affine connection, that will behave tensorially, even though the individual Christoffel symbol doesn't. Just because any differences, also infinitesimal differences, will have the offending term dropping out. All right, so now we are ready to ask, what are the equations of motion of matter fields in a curved space-time? Now, all of this is still classical. Next term, we'll do it quantum mechanically or quantum theoretically. But for now, it's classical. And so the equations of motion follow from an action principle. Any theory of matter fields can be defined by specifying the Lagrangian. Let's call it L. And the Lagrangian is a scalar function of all of the matter fields. So L is going to be some function of these fields. And their first derivatives, their first covariant derivatives, of course. And the metric can also be in there. But of course, the whole thing has to be covariant. We only want second order in time equations of motion. So therefore, we only allow in the Lagrangian the fields themselves and their first derivatives, no higher derivatives, because that would mean higher derivatives in the equations of motion. And that would mean that we would need to pose more initial conditions than two. In fact, even deeper problems can arise when we allow higher derivatives of the kind that we cannot even pose initial value problems. Okay, so we define the action functional. The action functional is some expression L of psi, which depends on the psis and their first covariant derivatives. And then we multiply that with the volume form. Remember that the volume form that is adjusted to the metric, that arises from the metric, is square root of the of the absolute value of the determinant of G. And we will simply write here square root of G, when really what is meant is the absolute value of the determinant of G. So this is a scalar function. This is an n-form. So the whole thing, scalar function times n-form, is an n-form. And as an n-form, it can be integrated over an n-dimensional space-time manifold. So B could be some bounded and closed four-dimensional region in space-time, or it could be all of the space-time. What we do require is that the action is always real. So overall, every choice of physical fields as functions of space and time can be plugged into this formula, and out pops a number, just a real number. So it maps bunches of field evolutions, because it's a field as a function of space and time. It maps histories, therefore, of the evolution of all the fields into one number, one real number, the action. And then the action principle says that in nature, the physical fields are such, well, the classical fields are such that this number, S of psi, is extrema in the space of all fields psi. We'll have to make that precise. What do we mean by this? So the statement is that in classical physics, the matter fields psi, and remember that includes electromagnetism, right? Because in cosmology, radiation is matter. So in classical physics, we say that the matter fields psi obey that the functional derivative of the action with respect to variations of the field is zero. And these are a lot of equations because we have a functional derivative with respect to each one of these psi. I just suppressed the index here, but of course, for every matter field, you get a different equation of motion here. But what's the definition of this? What is this really? Now, the usual strategy is to not think about it and just pretend as if we knew what it is, and we just differentiate and go ahead, right? But there is a better way to do this. There's a way to understand what is meant by varying the action with respect to fields. So let's briefly look into this. What is the definition of this action principle, really? For this, we first have to define what we mean by a variation of a field. So what is delta psi? What is a variation of a field psi I, where P is some point of the manifold? So the definition is that a variation of a field in some region B of the spacetime is a one-parameter deformation of the field, where we introduce a parameter lambda which takes values in some interval around zero. It could be a very small interval, but the point is it has to be some interval around zero. Let's say from minus epsilon to epsilon. So instead of just looking at a matter field, psi I of P, some matter field defined on the manifold, we are now looking at a family of matter fields parameterized by an extra parameter lambda. So this is still the matter field as a function of the position on the manifold, but it also has a parameter lambda that runs from minus epsilon to epsilon. And as we dial through the various values of lambda, this matter field can take different shapes. Right? So the matter field depends not only on the space-time location, but it also depends on that value of lambda. Now, in order to qualify as a variation of the original matter field, we require that, first of all, when the parameter that we introduced, when this lambda parameter is exactly zero, then this family of matter fields is exactly the family of matter fields that we started with, that we want to vary about. Okay? But then when lambda is not equal to zero, then this can differ. So we want some continuous, in fact, differentiable deformation of the original matter field. So it takes the original values for lambda equals zero, but as you dial through the lambda, the values can change. But secondly, we also want that the values only change, as you dial through the various values of lambda, that the values only change within some bounded domain in the space-time. So we pick some bounded domain B, and then we consider all the space-time events P, which are in the manifold, but not in B. So let us consider all those points outside that bounded domain. There, we don't want the variation to do anything. So no matter what the value of lambda is, we still get the original matter field outside a certain bubble, outside a certain region B. Okay? So we have a bounded region of space-time, and only inside that region are we varying the matter field. As we vary lambda, we are varying the values of the matter field. but only in that region B. And outside that region, for all P in M without B, we have that the deformation doesn't do anything, and we just keep everything the same. Okay, so there's some region in space-time where we change the matter field as lambda is varied, but outside we don't change it. And when lambda is equal to zero, then everything is the original field. Well, then we define the variation of our field psi to be literally the derivative of our family of matter fields with respect to lambda at lambda equal to zero. This is obviously zero outside the bubble, outside the region B. But inside the region B, this tells us how this family of matter fields changes away from lambda equal to zero. So that's the variation. And you can see that there are infinitely many different variations you can define, because there's infinitely many ways you can define a psi of lambda and p. It's just like differentiating in this direction or that direction or that direction. This is in an infinite dimensional space. There are infinitely many ways in which you can vary a field. Okay, so now the action principle made explicit takes this form. The action principle says that the action should not vary, its derivative should vanish with respect to lambda at lambda equal to zero for whatever variation you choose. Choosing a variation is choosing to introduce a lambda parameter in some matter field, and then in such a way that as you vary the lambda parameter, the matter field changes inside some region B, right? And there are infinitely many ways you can do this, how you can vary the field. And the action principle says that independently of how you choose to vary your field, how you introduce this lambda parameter, the action should be stationary with respect to variations of lambda at lambda equal to zero. So this is really infinitely many different equations. And now what we have achieved here is that we have reduced the previously somewhat unclear notation of del psi over del s over del psi. We have reduced this now to an ordinary derivative with respect to lambda. And the s is an actual expression in terms of the psi, in terms of integrals, and so on. And this psi now has a lambda in it. And so this is a very explicit thing. We just differentiate all the with respect to all of the occurrences of lambda and set that equal to zero. So it's now reduced to ordinary derivatives. The variations are reduced to ordinary derivatives. Now let's do this. Let's carefully rederive the equations of motion. You've seen this calculation before, pretty sure. Also, you may not have seen it on curved space-time. There's a subtlety. If you remember, when you derive the equations of motion, the Euler-Lagrange equations, then you have to throw away a boundary term. It's a usual thing. That arises because of an integration by parts that gives you a boundary term. But now we don't have ordinary derivatives. Now we have covariant derivatives. So it's slightly non-trivial to do the integration by parts and then to throw away the boundary term. But in principle, it's the same thing. We just do it covariantly. So here's how this looks like. The action principle says that the action has to be stationary with respect to any variation. So the derivative with respect to lambda has to be zero when lambda is equal to zero for any variation. In practice, it means this. If we write down what the S is, the S is an expression in terms of, it's the integral over the Lagrangian. And so if we now differentiate the action with respect to lambda, what do we get? We get the integral here over some region. We only get the integral over some region, and not over the entire space-time, because ds by d lambda is going to vanish outside that region because the variation is vanishing outside that region, remember. So what we have is it's the integral over, over some region, over the region in which we do the variation. And then we have the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to each of the fields. So we have the sum over the I, it's the sum over all species. And then the variation of psi, which we know what it is, right? It's d psi by d lambda, right? So it's really dl by d psi by d lambda. It's written out, d psi by d lambda. Plus, well, there are also dependencies on the covariant derivatives of psi. So we also need to differentiate the Lagrangian with respect to the covariant derivatives of all of the particle species. And then we have to vary with respect to, we have to vary all of these covariant derivatives of the matter fields. Now, this part we know how to handle. But that's new. What's the variation of not the field itself, but what's the variation of the covariant derivative of a field? That's what we need here. So let's consider these two terms separately, and in particular this. What's happening there? Okay, so the second term, in that second term, we have to evaluate the variation of the covariant derivative of a matter field. Now, this is actually the covariant derivative of the variation. But why? Couldn't there something go wrong? How do we know that varying commutes with covariant derivatives? Well, the way to see this is that at any point, I mean, we can look at any point in space-time here, pick a point, and then choose a geodesic coordinate system about that point, a Riemann normal coordinate system. When we do that, then the Christoffel symbol vanishes at that point, which means that at that point, the covariant derivative is the ordinary derivative. But that means that this statement is a statement just involving the variation, which is an ordinary derivative with respect to lambda, and this with a comma instead of a semicolon. So therefore, what we know is that if we choose at any given point a Riemann normal coordinate system, then that equation will hold true simply because of the commutativity of the derivative with respect to lambda and the derivative with respect to d by dxi. But if you have an equation that holds true at the origin of a Riemann normal coordinate system with ordinary derivatives, then that equation always also holds true in any coordinate system if you replace the ordinary derivative by the covariant derivative. Simply because there is no difference in the Riemann normal coordinate system. In the Riemann normal coordinate system, you can replace the ordinary derivative by the, covariant derivative because the Christoffel symbol is vanishing. So now you have a covariant equation, right, with the semicolon. But once you have a covariant equation, you can write it down in any coordinate system you want. So actually, the variation does commute. The differentiation with respect to lambda does commute with the spatial or space-time derivatives. So whether we vary the covariant derivative of a field or we covariantly differentiate the variation of the field, that's the same thing. So that means that the second term now that we obtained from our variational principle takes this form. The second term is derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the derivative of the covariant derivatives of the field species. And then instead of having the variation of the covariant derivative, we have the covariant derivative of the variation of the field. But then we can write this expression here as the difference between those two expressions. This is integration by part covariantly on a covariant space, on a curved space time. How do we see that? Well, take this expression here and covariantly differentiate it, using the fact that covariant derivatives obey the product rule, that they are a derivation. So what we obtain then is two terms. One term where this is untouched, and that term is covariantly differentiated. That is this term. But we also get, when we carry out that covariant derivative, we also get a term where this is untouched, and that term is covariantly differentiated. That wasn't present up here, so we have to undo this and have to subtract that term. That's that term here. It's the term where this got covariantly differentiated and that was carried forward. So this is two terms, and one of them we take away again. So the term that's left over is this one, integration by parts. Now, we recognize that this expression here is some contravariant vector field, because the A's and the B's and C and the D's and so on and the I's are all occurring twice, they're all being summed over, but we have here some index E that survives, and that's then contracted with that E over here. So overall, this expression takes the form K superscript E and then subscript semicolon E. It's going to be important, because that's going to be the boundary term. Okay, so this term is going to be a boundary term. And here's how we see this. Okay, it's this term where we sum over the species, and then the K, in principle, has the species index. I should write it here. See? Because, see, there are the I in there, and therefore this vector here has a species index I down here. Remember, the species index I is not a tensor index. That's why it's in brackets. It just labels, you know, whether we're dealing with quarks or photons or whatever. Okay, so what we have is the sum of all species, and we integrate over the region over which we vary. And then we have here this contravariant vector field E that we covariantly differentiate with respect to XE. But this is actually a divergence. I leave it to you as a little exercise, or maybe we even did it at the time when we did divergences. Not sure, but in any case, it's not difficult to show that this is actually the divergence. As you might have expected, remember that in flat space, the divergence of a vector field is just obtained in this way, right? Just with the ordinary derivatives. Now it's the covariant derivative, and we have the regular volume form here. So what we obtain is that this term is the sum of all species, and then the integral over the region that, over which we vary, and then it's the divergence of our vector field K with respect to the volume form omega. Volume form being this. Now let me remind you of what we know about the volume form. What we know about the divergence. So the divergence is the Lie derivative of the volume form in the direction of the vector field of which we calculate the divergence. I think it was lecture 7 where we did this. And the Lie derivative, if you remember, the Lie derivative is the anti-commutator of the inner derivation and the exterior derivation. The Lie derivative is inner derivation after exterior derivative plus exterior derivation after inner derivation. Everybody remember how the inner derivation works? You feed the vector into the form as the first argument. Okay, so then we have that expression acting on our volume form. But you see, the volume form is an N form, it's a top form, it's a top degree, which means that when we act with this exterior derivative on it, it's going to kill it, right? Because an N form, the D of an N form would be an N plus 1 form, but there is no such thing. So, because you can't anti-symmetrize N plus 1 terms in an N-dimensional space. So that term goes away because the D annihilates the volume form. So we're just left with this. But that's super important because we have a D here, right? So we have that this is equal to the integral over D after the inner derivation of omega. But then we can use Stokes' theorem and integrate instead of integrating over that volume, we can integrate by Stokes' theorem over just the boundary and drop the D. So overall, this term, this divergence, becomes over a volume, integrating this divergence over a volume becomes a surface term, where we just integrate that, where we take the volume form and we plug the vector field K as the first argument into the volume form. But then our vector field K is proportional to the variation of the field psi. And remember that the field psi, the variation of the field psi is actually vanishing on that boundary. That was a condition of our variation. We say that the variation vanishes, is non-zero only inside a certain bubble, only inside a certain region and outside and on the boundary, we want this to vanish. So therefore, that actually vanishes and so the whole term goes away. And that means that only the other term survives. We just show you again which term survives. Okay, so, all right. So we have that the second term becomes the sum of these two, and that's just a divergence. It's a boundary term that vanishes, and we're just left with this term here. Okay. So the second term simplifies, and what we obtain finally is that the action principle tells us that the derivative of the action with respect to lambda for whichever variation of the field we choose gives us this. The sum of all species and integration over the region over which we vary. Then the first term was the variation of the Lagrangian with respect to the matter fields, and then the variation of the matter fields, and then minus, that's the surviving term after the integration by parts, minus the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the matter field, to the covariant derivatives of the matter field, covariantly differentiated again, and then the variations of the matter fields. The point being that here we have the variations of the matter field, and there we have the variations of the matter field. That was the whole point of the integration by parts. If you remember, it's the same thing in Minkowski space. We need to get rid of the derivatives on the variation of the field. And we do that by integration by parts. So we have the extra covariant derivative over here. And then we have the variation of the field here and the variation of the field there. So therefore, these two terms just multiply the variation of the field. But since the variation of the field is completely arbitrary, the difference between those two terms has to vanish. And so we can conclude that this minus that has to vanish, which is the Euler-Lagrange equation. So this term minus that term has to vanish. So this is the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the matter fields minus the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the covariant derivative of the matter fields covariantly differentiated. So these are covariantly the Euler-Lagrange equations. So this gives us the equation of motion for any matter field here. Let's start with the simplest example. Let's start with a scalar field psi. And let's keep it simple and say it's a real-valued scalar field. Real-valued scalar fields describe, for example, pi zero mesons, which are particles that are consisting of one quark and one antiquark, or also the inflaton particle. So what would be the Lagrangian for such a field? How do we find the covariant Lagrangian? Well, we use the equivalence principle. So we choose a geodesic coordinate system at some arbitrary point, write down the equation of motion that we know from special relativity, And then at the origin of a geodesic coordinate system, we can turn the ordinary derivatives into covariant derivatives, because the Christoffel symbol that we add is zero anyway. But at that point, we arrive then at a covariant expression, which we can then write down in any coordinate system. So here, in practice, it means we take the Lagrangian for a Klein-Gordon field, for a scalar field psi. We take that Lagrangian, which is minus 1/2, and then this without the semicolons, that's the Lagrangian of special relativity. And then we write it down at the origin of some geodesic coordinate system, where we can put the semicolons instead of ordinary commas. We literally don't change anything when we do this, because the Christoffel symbol is vanishing there. But then we obtain a covariant equation out of this. And then we say, OK, it's a covariant equation. This may hold no matter what. And then once we have that Lagrangian, we can plug everything into that, into those formulas above, and we can derive what the Lagrange equation is. And here it is. This is another way of writing the Klein-Gordon equation. Second covariant derivative of psi, and then contracted with a metric, minus psi equal to zero. It's a good exercise that you do this. Just, you know, plug the action up there and just see that you get the Klein-Gordon equation in this way. Next example, the electromagnetic field. To keep things simple, at first, let's assume that there are no charges. Later, we will introduce charges as well. Let's, for now, assume that it's just the electromagnetic field. There are only electromagnetic waves when there are no charges, right? And no currents. So now we define the electromagnetic four potential, what you know as the field A mu. Differential geometrically, this is a one form. It's a real number valued one form. Let's call it A. And then, and I think you've seen this before in the lecture that Nitika gave a few weeks ago, right? I think she did the electromagnetism in differential geometric language. I think it's lecture 7. Okay, so the electromagnetic four potential, A, has as its exterior derivative what is called the field strength tensor. Field strength tensor is a two form, and while A has as a one form, is just a cotangent vector, and therefore it has n entries. It has four entries on our spacetime. F is a two form. So therefore, it is, when you write it down as a covariant antisymmetric two tensor, then it's a 4x4 matrix that's antisymmetric. And it has the electric and the magnetic field components in it. And if you don't remember, please look it up in lecture 7. We have explicitly how the electric and the magnetic field sit in this field strength tensor. Okay, so the E and the B fields are components of the two-form F. Now, what is the Lagrangian? The Lagrangian of electromagnetism is minus 1 over 16 pi, and then just F, the field strength tensor, and then contracted. By the way, do you know what that is if you write it out in terms of E and B field? You see, the F contains the E field and the B field in it. And it's basically E squared minus B squared. But again, you know, don't trust me on that. Do it. Okay. So then, if we plug this Lagrangian in our other Lagrange equation up there, this is the equation of motion that we find. It's that the field strength tensor covariantly differentiated and then contracted is equal to zero. we had this equation before, well, Nitika had it before, lecture 7, and it's, this equation can also be written as the co-derivative of the field strength tensor being equal to 0. Actually, Nitika did it with charges and currents on the right-hand side. So there it was that the co-derivative of the field strength tensor is equal to, and then you have here a 4 current. These are called the inhomogeneous Maxwell equations, because in principle, there could be charges and currents over there, which make these equations inhomogeneous. There are also the homogeneous Maxwell equations. And homogeneous Maxwell equations take this form. Let me show you something. Remember the definition of F. F was the exterior derivative of the one form A. So therefore, we can conclude that df has to be 0, because it's d squared of a. So df is equal to 0. When you spell that out, what df equal to 0 is, it's the homogeneous Maxwell equation. This equation is simply saying that df is equal to 0. But if you look at it closely, something seems off, because there are semicolons in here. And the df is something we could define without ever knowing what an affine connection is, without ever knowing what the non-trivial metric is. Remember, we defined the exterior derivative before metrics and before affine connections. Df equal to 0 holds no matter what. It doesn't depend on the existence or absence of an affine connection or a metric. And now I'm saying that this is df equal to 0. Now, the resolution to this is, again, this subtle point. If you choose a Riemann normal coordinate system around some point, and you calculate what df equal to 0 is, you find this equation here with the commas, not the semicolons. But because you're at the origin of a Riemann normal coordinate system, you can always add your Christoffel symbols and make these covariant derivatives, because the Christoffel symbols vanish there. So the equation then holds with the semicolons, not just with the commas, but also with the semicolons. But any equation that holds with the semicolons, any covariant equation like that, then holds in whatever coordinate system you choose. So therefore, the homogeneous Maxwell equations can be written with the comma, but they can also be written with a semicolon. And both are true, and both are generally not the same equations, because the Christoffel symbol is generally not 0. It just so works out that because of the index structure, the Christoffel symbol terms always drop out. So even though it seems as if the homogeneous Maxwell equations somehow know about the curvature of the spacetime, they really don't, because you could just drop the Christoffel symbols from that equation. Okay, so the Maxwell equations come in two forms. There are the inhomogeneous Maxwell equations with charges and currents, and there are the homogeneous Maxwell equations. The homogeneous Maxwell equations are not physical. They are important for physics, but the origin is mathematical, not physical. The origin of the homogeneous Maxwell equations is simply that d squared is equal to 0. Right? F is dA, so therefore df is 0, because it's d squared a. So there's no way that this would ever be found differently. You don't have to check experiments for this. It's a part of the mathematics, because this is a non-trivial statement physically. OK, so the homogeneous Maxwell equation is simply this one. Now, let's make things a little more complicated by considering electromagnetism along with charges and currents. But let's not do the full Dirac equation just yet. We'll do that in a moment, but the Dirac equation has its own non-trivialities. Let us just look at what we obtain when we couple a scalar field that is charged to electromagnetism. I should say something about scalar fields. When a scalar field is real valued, electromagnetism doesn't see it. A real valued scalar field has no charge, no electromagnetic charge. If you want the electromagnetic field to see a charge, then the field that carries the charge cannot be real. It has to be complex. So let's look at the complex valued scalar field psi. For example, could be the pi plus or pi minus meson. It's not a fundamental particle, a pi plus or pi minus, because it's made out of two quarks. But still, it occurs all over the place, easy to make. It's an important particle. So now, using the equivalence principle, we can derive what the Lagrangian is from special relativity. So from special relativity, we know that we have to write down this Lagrangian with the ordinary derivatives, with commas, and then we turn it into the general relativistic version by turning the commas into semicolons, with the usual trick saying that special relativity has to hold at the origin of the Riemann-Homer coordinate system, and then we can introduce the Christoffel symbol, and then it's covariant, and then it holds in all coordinate systems and on curved space-time. So the Lagrangian is now, oh, by the way, here I gave you a little calculation to show why a field has to be complex in order to be seen as charged by the electromagnetic field. I have you read this on your own time, in some time. Okay, so the equivalence principle gives us that this is the Lagrangian for the electromagnetic field and a scalar Klein-Gordon field, which is charged, which is to say that it's a complex valued field. So our Klein-Gordon field has the following terms. We have here a psi star psi. See, there are several terms involved. There's a psi star psi term, but these are derivatives of psi. So you can view this as like the velocity squared. This is the kinetic term of the Klein-Gordon field in the action. And then contracted with the GAB, right? So it's just Klein-Gordon field, Klein-Gordon field. And in here we have the mass term, psi star psi. So this term plus that term is just the ordinary Klein-Gordon action, where we've taken care that we took psi star psi, and here also psi star psi, so that the Lagrangian is real. What about the electromagnetic field? Its action should also be somewhere. Well, sure, here it is. Remember, that was the action for just the electromagnetic field. So if it was only independently the Klein-Gordon field and the electromagnetism that don't see each other, then it would be just this term and that term for the Klein-Gordon field and that term for the electromagnetism. But the gauge principle tells us that this is actually to be there as well. So these terms are coupling the electromagnetic field to the Klein-Gordon field, right? Because it's multiplying the two, which means that when we calculate the Euler-Lagrange equations for the Klein-Gordon field, then they will contain the electromagnetic field. And if you do a functional derivative with respect to psi star, we are going to get a term with an A. And vice versa, when we do the variation or the functional derivative, same thing, with respect to the electromagnetic field, then we're not just getting terms over here, we are also getting terms over there, which include the psi. So therefore, the Maxwell equations will be modified by having a dependence on the psi, and the Klein-Gordon equations will be modified by having a dependence on the A. Therefore, these two fields will see each other, they will interact with each other. So we need to take this complicated action and vary it with respect to psi to get the Euler Lagrange equations for the Klein-Gordon field, and vary it with respect to A to get the Euler Lagrange equation, the equation of motion for the electromagnetic field. So when we vary with respect to psi, then a little calculation shows that the Klein-Gordon equation becomes this equation here. This is the second derivative of psi, second covariant derivative of psi. And here we have the mass term. And if there was no electromagnetic field, if the A was zero, everything over here would be going away. And it would be just this is equal to zero. It would be the Klein-Gordon field, the Klein-Gordon equation, this equal to zero. But now we have all of this as well. These terms are coupling the electromagnetic field to the Klein-Gordon field. So the Klein-Gordon field's equation of motion is modified. The presence of the electromagnetic field means that our scalar field is evolving differently. And once quantized, it means that, you know, the Klein-Gordon particles see the presence of photons. Okay, so psi is affected by A. But it also works the other way around. Oh, and by the way, what happens if we vary with respect to psi? If we take the action and vary it with respect to psi, we obtain exactly the same equation except complex conjugate. But the complex conjugate equation contains the exact same information as the original equation. So it suffices to vary with respect to psi star. Now, when we take our complete action and functionally differentiate it or vary it with respect to the electromagnetic field, well, then we get this equation of motion. If the Klein-Gordon field was absent, if psi was equal to zero, all of that on the right would be gone. And the equation of motion would be simply this one. This is equal to zero, which is the inhomogeneous Maxwell equation, right? This is the coderivative of F equal to zero. But instead of equal to zero, we have it's equal to all of this. All of this should be on the right-hand side. And what is that on the right-hand side? That's basically charges and currents. Charges and currents that influence our electromagnetic field. So the electromagnetic field is influenced by the presence of psi, by the presence of the Klein-Gordon field, and vice versa. The Klein-Gordon field is influenced by the presence of the electromagnetic field. So what this means is that if you want to calculate the dynamics of a pion field and the dynamics of the electromagnetic field simultaneously, classically, then that's what you have to do on curved space-time. You have to solve these partial differential equations simultaneously to those partial differential equations on the background of this space-time. We haven't even taken into account that these two fields are going to curve space-time. They're going to impact space-time. So if you assume you know the curvature of space-time, and you assume that that curvature is very little impacted by what the pion field and what the electromagnetic field is doing, then you can proceed as we just said. You can simply take your space-time as a given. So you know what the covariant derivative is. You take your Christoffel symbols as given. And then you can solve the generalized Maxwell equation along with the generalized Klein-Gordon equation simultaneously. And then you obtain how these fields evolve on a curved space-time, for example, on the background of a black hole. Now, when is this justified? Well, it's justified when these fields have little impact on the space-time. For example, you could have a massive black hole and just a little bit of a pion field and a little bit of electromagnetism. They're not going to make much of a dent in space-time. But of course, later on, we'll have to take that into account. We will calculate what the energy momentum tensor is that the Klein-Gordon field is producing. The energy momentum tensor that the electromagnetic field is producing, that all the fields are producing. And then the energy momentum tensor that they are producing, that is impacting space-time. So overall, the full picture that we cannot do yet, because we haven't done the Einstein equation, the full picture will be that we will have to solve this modified Maxwell equation simultaneously with the modified Klein-Gordon equation, simultaneously with the Einstein equation. Can you imagine how super difficult all of that is? But that would be not assuming anything and would have everything influence everything, right? So the Klein-Gordon field influences gravity and electromagnetism. The electromagnetism influences gravity and the Klein-Gordon field. And so each one of the three is influencing the two others. And of course, that's really what's happening in the standard model. We have lots of different fields, and they all influence gravity. They all influence each other. And gravity influences all of them. So we, in principle, have to solve all of those differential equations simultaneously. And that's just the classical part of it. And then we'd have to quantize it too. All right. So now the Dirac equation. There is so much to be said about spinners, and I very much recommend that you follow the hint and look at Hawking and Ellis' book, I think it's page 59 onwards, about spinners. Super interesting stuff, the Clifford algebra and how it sits in the algebra of differential forms. But here let's do a more direct approach that doesn't involve building up Clifford algebras. Okay, so in special relativity, the Dirac equation looks like this. I hope you've all seen it. Has everybody seen the Dirac equation before? Who has not seen the Dirac equation? A few of you have not seen the Dirac. Okay, good. Okay, so the history of the Dirac equation is this. The Schrödinger equation is first order in time. Right, so we have I dt psi equal to minus well, let's just say time, okay, or equal to zero. And when Dirac saw that, he thought that can't be right. This is not covariant. We have a first derivative here, and we have second derivatives in space over there. No way that that would be covariant. Now, how to make this covariant? Klein-Gordon had the same trouble as Dirac, and they looked at this and said, this is not covariant. So what Klein and Gordon did is they said, okay, that's not covariant, but what if we write minus dt squared psi plus Laplacian psi equals zero? Now, that's covariant. Okay, because this is the D'Alembertian. I mean, I'm just talking Minkowski space for now. And so that was quite popular until they figured out that that's not really working very well because you get negative energies. See, if you think of it in the context of first quantization, then this would be the energy operator. And if you take the second derivative here, then you obtain that for any positive energy solution, there's a negative energy solution, and that was a bit of a nightmare. Ultimately, this was resolved by second quantization. In quantum field theory, the problem doesn't arise anymore. But they didn't know that yet. They were still working on covariantizing first quantization, the Schrödinger equation. So Klein and Gordon did this. But then Dirac said, well, okay, it's covariant, but it's nonsense because it has this negative energy solution. And arbitrarily negative energy solutions. You see, that's a problem because if you have any physical system that has a Hamiltonian that's not bounded from below, then that would make the universe collapse, right? Because it would be very unstable because that system could drop further and further down in its energy while emitting radiation. It's an unlimited source of energy. Right? So you can't have that. And Hamiltonians need to be bounded from below. Which is why H-bar stabilizes the universe. See, if you had that an atom was classical, you could have that the electron drops further, I mean, further and further inside. So it would be closer and closer to the proton. It would drop further and further down in the potential while emitting light. In fact, it would accelerate doing this. So if there wasn't a stable Bohr orbit of the hydrogen atom, then the electron could get closer and closer to the proton or I mean, a proton has a finite size. Let's say a positron. So the electron would get closer and closer to the positron, orbiting it closer and closer, drop further and further down in this negative potential, which is a 1 over r potential. It goes all the way down to minus infinity, while emitting photons at a higher and higher rate. That would be the ultimate explosion. It would never stop. It would just be exploding the universe. So why is it that there is a stable lowest orbit, a lower bound to the energy of the hydrogen atom or any other atom? Because of the uncertainty principle, right? If delta x gets too small, if the electron gets too confined close to the nucleus, if delta x gets too small, delta p becomes too large, in the sense that delta p becomes so large that the electron can escape again, right? So the electron cannot go to a too narrow orbit, because if it was at a very, very narrow orbit, delta x would be very small, but delta p would then be so large that it can escape from that narrow orbit. So there is a stable smallest orbit because of the uncertainty principle. So what this means is that the uncertainty principle saves our universe. Every atom would be unstable if there wasn't the uncertainty principle. The stability of matter hinges on it, right? Because if there wasn't a smallest lower orbit, right, then you could always squeeze things closer together. The stability of this is the uncertainty principle. I'm banging against the uncertainty principle here, right? Now, there is one more situation where this could happen, where the uncertainty principle doesn't necessarily save us, and that's gravity, right? You could have that matter just collapses into itself, and then it's not an electron that gets closer and closer to the positron. No, it's a star that's collapsing more and more and more, and it could just fall into this 1 over r gravitational potential, if it wasn't for gr, if it was classical gravity, it could just fall into this stronger and stronger attraction, 1 over r, right? And then it could emit all sorts of radiation as unlimited source of energy, because it's, you know, it goes arbitrarily far down in this negative potential. Total energy is conserved, so there must be positive energy shooting out. And what prevents that from happening? That's the formation of a black hole horizon. Right? So it's gravity in this case, it's general relativity that saves the universe from that collapse. You see, if it wasn't for the uncertainty principle and GR, the universe wouldn't be stable against collapse. Anyway, so that was a bit of a tangent. So Klein and Gordon tried to upgrade the Schrödinger equation to make it covariant by lifting this to a second derivative. But then Dirac thought, yeah, okay, covariant, but we have these negative energies, the universe would be unstable. So therefore, Dirac thought, let's make this covariant by lowering that derivative. Instead of having second derivatives here, have first derivatives there. But how could that possibly work? Well, here is how it works. You just have first derivatives here. So d by dt is the first term, this one, just like in the Schrödinger equation. But then you also get d by dxi. But then how to make this covariant? So Dirac just pulled out of the head, out of a hat, the idea of contracting this with some gammas and saying, let's worry about what the gammas could be a little later. And he just said, let's contract this with some four-vector gamma mu such that this becomes a scalar. Well, then if we can do this, then we have a covariant equation, except what could the gamma possibly be? Now, let me show you how this goes on. We get to the gammas in a moment. Let's just play along for a moment. Dirac found that the gamma have to be matrices. The details I'll explain in a moment. Have to be matrices. And the smallest dimension that they could have, he found, is 4. There is a way to make it 2, but generically it's 4. So he had to postulate that these fields, psi of x, are 4-component fields, a so-called spinner. And that's the thing that will describe spin 1/2 particles, such as electrons, positrons, quarks. And he postulated that these gammas are matrices which act on these four spinners. So these gammas would be 4x4 matrices. And he required that these 4x4 matrices obey this particular anti-commutation rule. It's gamma mu, gamma nu, plus, not minus, but plus, gamma nu, gamma mu, equal to 2 eta mu nu, where eta is the Minkowski metric. Which is, you know, just diagonal with a minus 1, 1, 1, 1. Now, why would Dirac postulate such a thing? See, Dirac noticed ingeniously that if you choose, if you can find gamma matrices, if you can find matrices gamma that obey these anti-commutation relations, then the Dirac equation implies the Klein-Gordon equation. So he found an ingenious way of finding solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation in a first order differential equation. Let's see how that works. Remember, Dirac's equation was this. I just blocked this out. This is Dirac's equation, right? Gamma nu del nu minus m psi equal to zero. Now, if this is equal to zero, then I can multiply from the left with whatever I want. It's still zero, right? Because this expression is zero, I can multiply with whatever I want. So in particular, let's multiply with this expression, which is the same as that, but with a minus sign over there. So if the Dirac equation holds, then that holds, right? Because the Dirac equation is this. Multiply with that, still true. But let's work it out, what that is. So we get this term times that term, that's here. And then we get the mixed terms, they are there, and they cancel each other out. Because we have here minus sign. It's over here. Oh, sorry, it's over here. So overall, we get this term, you know, the gamma gamma term is this one, and we get the m squared term. Now, the product of two derivatives, or the execution of two first derivatives, is commutative. So this is symmetric, which means that we can write this expression also as the 1/2 of this way around plus that way around, gamma mu plus m squared. Imagine when Dirac first did this calculation. It was not clear that that would lead to anywhere. He must have thought, let's see where this is going. Okay, so he rewrote this in that way. And then he realized that if we postulate that the gamma matrices obey this anti-commutation rule that we just saw above, if we postulate that this is equal to the eta of special relativity, well, then this becomes the Klein-Gordon equation, right? If this is the eta times the identity in the space of 4x4 matrices, then this is simply the Klein-Gordon equation for each component of this spinner vector. That's why he postulated that these gammas have to obey these anti-commutation relations. And then he just looked for the lowest dimension in which he could make this work, which is 4. So then he postulated, okay, the psi have to be 4 spinners, and these matrices have to be 4x4 matrices. And there are many ways that you can find 4x4 matrices. You need 4 4x4 matrices, gamma 0 to gamma 3, which obey these anti-commutation relations. And it doesn't matter which representation you choose. They are all related by just changes of basis. Okay, so he obtained, therefore, the Dirac equation, where his aim was to find a first-order generalization of the Schrödinger equation that is covariant, and he could prove the covariance by showing that every component obeys the Klein-Gordon equation, which is manifestly covariant. Now, how to do this in general relativity? See, there is a bit of a problem here. which is that the gamma matrices need to have this anti-commutation relation, where on the right-hand side is the special relativistic eta matrix. That is the eta mu nu, which is minus 1, 1, 1, 1 on the diagonal. But in curved space-time, the metric generally is not simply minus 1, 1, 1, 1. It's something generic. So if you want to follow Dirac straightforwardly, it would seem that at every point in space-time, we would have to check, what's the metric here? And then we find it's some weird 4x4 matrix. And then we have to go and find gamma matrices that have this anti-commutation relation, such that on the right-hand side of the anti-commutator of the gamma matrices, there is this weird metric. And we would have to do this at every point in space-time. That would be a hell of a job to do. There's a better way to do this, by remembering that the reason why the metric in general relativity takes this weird form, that depending on where you are, it's a different 4x4 matrix, that is a choice of bases of your tangent spaces and cotangent spaces. It doesn't have to be this way. If you choose your bases in your tangent and cotangent spaces suitably, then you can have that the metric tensor is the eta everywhere. Is it clear why that would be so? Remember that at any point in space-time, we can choose a Riemann normal coordinate system. We can center a Riemann normal coordinate system about any point of our space-time. And at the origin of the Riemann normal coordinate system, the metric is eta, eta mu nu. Right? We established that. Which means that at the origin of a Riemann normal coordinate system, you can read off which basis of the cotangent space diagonalizes the metric to be minus 1, 1, 1, 1. Okay? So if you choose those basis vectors in your cotangent space, then the metric is eta. It's minus 1, 1, 1. But that's all you need to write down the metric. You need to know on what basis to write it down. So now what you can do is you can choose for any point in your space-time manifold. You can choose that set of basis vectors in the cotangent space, which will make the metric look like minus 1, 1, 1, 1. That is not going to be a choice of basis vectors that comes automatically with any choice of coordinates. You have to make use of the freedom to choose your basis vectors whichever way you want. Okay? So what we can do is we can choose our coordinates on our space-time whichever way we want. But let us cleverly choose our basis vectors in the cotangent spaces. We can choose the basis vectors everywhere to be such that the metric everywhere is eta. Okay? This is quite unusual. As long as you are thinking that the basis vectors, the choice of bases in the tangent and cotangent spaces is linked to the choice of coordinate system, you could never have that, because the metric tensor would transform wildly while you change coordinates. But the moment you free yourself from that, And you see that the coordinate system could be one thing. Your choice of bases in the tangent spaces is another thing. Then you see that you can choose whatever coordinate system you want. You can always choose at every point, simultaneously, you can choose at every point a clever choice of bases such that the metric tensor is minus 1, 1, 1, 1. And so where is the information then? It used to be in the metric tensor, right? The metric tensor has this non-trivial dependence on space-time, and that's encoding the metric. That's encoding the space-time. That's the usual way of thinking of it. But it's not. It's only if you link the two, if you link your choice of basis to the choice of coordinate system. If you unlink them, then the information about the curvature of the space-time is now in telling which basis you have to choose at every point. If you say that at every point in space-time, this is the choice of basis which diagonalizes the metric, then you are intrinsically telling what the curvature of space-time is by doing that. Okay, we can use this now to do the Dirac equation on curved space-time. Because what you will do, of course, is choose a basis in the cotangent space, an orthonormal tetrad theta I, such that at every point in the manifold, the metric tensor is simply the Itam union. That's super convenient because it means that we don't have to come up with new gamma matrices at every point. We can simply, at every point, just use the ordinary gamma matrices. Okay, so we choose gamma matrices, and you can look them up. If you want to see them explicitly, you can just look up any book on quantum field theory. The gamma matrices have end commutation relations, which are 2 eta mu nu. We choose them once and for all. And then the Dirac equation ought to be, the covariant version of the Dirac equation ought to be gamma matrices and then covariant derivative in the direction of E mu minus M psi equal to 0. So we're simply replacing the d by dx mu by the covariant derivative in the direction of the basis vectors. But what is the covariant derivative of a spinner? See, we haven't had that yet. What is the covariant derivative of a spinner in the direction of some basis vector E mu? Now, in order to work that out, you can do it 2 ways. You can either go into the theory of Clifford algebras, which I would recommend, but would take us too far, or we do it this way by doing it, by deriving it constructively. So remember that the covariant derivative of a vector field is what? The covariant derivative of a vector field tells us the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation by which a vector rotates if we infinitesimally parallel transport it. The covariant derivative of a spinner field should give us the infinitesimal rotation that the spinner experiences when exposed to that infinitesimal Lorentz transformation, when exposed to that same infinitesimal parallel transport. So what do we know? We have that under infinitesimal parallel transport of a vector E rho in the direction of a vector E mu, we have that the E rho vector goes into the E rho vector plus the covariant derivative, which is basically Taylor expanding, the covariant derivative of our vector E rho in the direction E mu. That's what the affine connection does. And we wrote this in terms of the connection one form. Sorry, I wrote here curvature one form, but it's the connection one form. So the connection one form works like this. Remember, it's very important. Connection one form has one covariant slot. What you've put in there is the direction in which you want to parallel transport. This is the direction vector in which you, it's the direction in which you want to covariant the differentiate. That's what goes in here. And then this matrix that you get out of it is an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. Okay, so the original vector goes into the original vector plus infinitesimal Lorentz transformation acting on the E rho. So the E rho goes into infinitesimal Lorentz transformation acting on E rho, where this total Lorentz transformation is the identity plus a little bit, and that little bit is the infinitesimal part of it. It's, you know, you plug in the direction vector in which you want to differentiate, and then you get this infinitesimal matrix. And we had as a property before that this, when you lower both indices, is antisymmetric, and that is the condition for this being an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. I give you more details in black down there. Okay. Now we know how to obtain the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation for any infinitesimal parallel transport. Namely, we take the connection one form, we plug in the direction in which we want to differentiate, and out pops a matrix, the omega matrix, right? And that's the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. Now what we need to do is infinitesimally Lorentz transform our spinner field in this way. So for this, let's remember from special relativity how an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation acts on a spinner. Now, three of you haven't seen a Dirac equation before, but those of you who have seen it hopefully remember this. So imagine, assume that the SI are an orthonormal basis in the space of spinners. So these are four basis vectors in the space of spinners. So our spinner valued field, let's say for the electron, can be written as coefficient function times basis vector in spinner space. We have four of them. And we label them typically from 1 to 4, not from 0 to 3, because they are not space-time indices, but spinner indices. Then the question is, how do these basis vectors, Si, transform under Lorentz transformations? And in particular, under infinitesimal ones, what is the action of the affine connection on spinners rather than vectors or tensors? See, this should be an equation that's analogous to what we have for vectors. The affine connection, the covariant derivative of a vector in the direction of a vector, is given by connection one form acting on that vector, right? So you plug in the direction vector, you get infinitesimal Lorentz transformation out of it. Okay, so from special relativity, it is known that under an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation, an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation is always the identity plus something small, and that has to be anti-symmetric. We know that under small Lorentz transformations, vectors transform in this way. The vector goes into the vector plus this. I'm just literally spelling out what this is. You know, the identity plus the action of omega, the identity plus the action of omega. And now I have to remind you of something. I hope you remember this. It's a little tedious to derive all of that, but I gave you a whole box of explanations over here. In special relativity, I hope you've seen that the basis vectors in spinner space transform under infinitesimal Lorentz transformations omega nu mu in the following way. The spinner basis vector goes into the spinner basis vector minus a quarter, and then here we have that Lorentz transformation matrix, and then here we have a 4x4 matrix which acts on the space of spinners. And this is a generator of rotations in spinner space. Where would this come from? Remember, I told you some time ago that translations are generated by the derivative operator. Okay? So if you write down e to the power a d by dx, f of x, then this is f of x plus a. And we say that this is a generator of translations. Similarly, e to the power of, let's say, alpha, and then you do lz, where lz, you know, is x1 dx2 minus dx2 x1, I think. If you act with this one on f of x vector, then this is f of r x vector, where this is a rotation by alpha about the z axis. Okay? So we have generators of translations, generators of rotations, and then there are generators of Lorentz transformations, which are generalizing the action of LZ. There are more of them for Lorentz transformations than just rotations. And then what we are after here is the analogon for spinners, not for, you know, translating in space or rotating in space, but rotations or Lorentz transformations in spinner space. And so what we have here is the infinitesimal version of that. If we take this and just take the first order expansion of this. You see, this is 1 plus a d by dx plus 1 half a squared d by dx squared, etc., right? If you just take the first non-trivial term, then you get the infinitesimal part of it, the derivative of it. And similarly here for the rotations. And that's what we have here too. You just take infinitesimal. It's just the first order in the Taylor expansion. This is the identity term, and it's the first order term. And it can be shown that these guys obey the canonical commutation relations of the generators of Lorentz transformation. And that's why they occur here. Please read this sometime. They occur here. You can take these commutators of gamma matrices and exponentiate them with some angles, either for spatial rotations or imaginary angles for boosts, and then you get Lorentz transformations. Lorentz transformations that act on the space of spinners, because these guys are 4x4 matrices. Okay, so what we found is how spinners transform under infinitesimal Lorentz transformations. And we know which infinitesimal Lorentz transformation we have to apply. It's the one that comes out of the connection one form. So if a vector is infinitesimally parallel transported in a direction of EA, then it obtains an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation given by the connection one form. This is the direction in which you parallel transport, and then that is the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. Now that infinitesimal Lorentz transformation has to be applied not just here to a vector, but to a spinner. So this is what we had for vectors. Covariant derivative of a vector is equal to infinitesimal Lorentz transformation acting on a vector. But in this case, it was all very simple. We have to do it with these generators that we just saw for the spinner space. So what we have is that under infinitesimal parallel transport, we have an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation of our vectors and of our spinners. And this is the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. And that multiplied with these generators gives us the infinitesimal rotation in spinner space. So this expression here, that's the rotation matrix. That's the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. That's the alpha up here. It's the analog of the alpha. And this multiplied with a minus 1/4 is the analog of LZ. Except that here it's just rotations in space. And it's the space-time degrees of freedom. And there, it's Lorentz transformations acting on spin space. Okay, so since we know that the affine connection has to accomplish this, we can read off what the affine connection has to be. So the affine connection, the covariant derivative in the direction of the vector EA of a spinner has to be this. So from that, we obtain that the covariant derivative of a spinner is this expression here. Connection one form contracted with these generators of Lorentz transformations in spinner space. And in general, let's now apply this to get finally to the Dirac equation. So the spinners in the Dirac equation, psi of x, can be written as a linear combination of the basis vectors in the space of spinner fields. And then when we apply the covariant derivative, we obtain by the product rule that the covariant derivative of our spinner vector field gives us two terms, one from differentiating this, one different from differentiating that. Remember, this is a spinner. These are just scalar functions. So the covariant derivative of this psi is given by covariant derivative of psi I s I, two terms, one term where we differentiate these scalar functions, where we could also write just the ordinary partial derivatives because it's a scalar function, while leaving the spinners alone, and then leaving the scalar prefactors alone, and covariantly differentiating the spinner basis. And we know what that is, namely we get this term. So therefore, the covariant derivative of the spinner field is given by ordinary derivative in the A direction of psi, because that's just a scalar function. Covariant derivative is ordinary derivative. Ordinary derivative is just what the vector field does. Then minus this expression here, we're just plugging in what we now know of the affine connection. Now we know what it does on spinner basis, right? So finally, we can write down our Dirac equation. You see, it's pretty elegant to write it like this, but it's actually quite a mess when you write it out explicitly what it is. Right? If we spell out exactly what this is, now that we know what the covariant derivative in the direction of E mu is of psi, where psi is the product of coefficient functions times basis vectors, well, then we obtain that the Dirac equation takes this form. The mass term just carries forward, but then by the product rule, we get a term where we differentiate the coefficient function and a term where we differentiate, where we have the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. So this is what we get anew from curvature. Other than that, it's the ordinary Dirac equation, but that part is new, the connection one form. Okay, so now the relationship between the Dirac operator and the Laplace operator is also an interesting one. Remember, I told you that there is a way to define another product, a Clifford product, on the differential forms, such that you don't get the Grassmann algebra, but you get Clifford algebra, in which you can identify the spinners. Now, if so, it ought to be possible to express the Dirac operator that we derived here in a relatively pedestrian way, relatively straightforward, but sort of not really elegant. There ought to be a way to get the Dirac operator more intrinsic in a more elegant way. Now, remember that Dirac found that every component of a spinner field obeys the Klein-Gordon equation, which means that the Dirac operator, oh, what do we mean by the Dirac operator? The Dirac operator is this thing, right? When you take the first derivative, first covariant derivative, and contract it with the gamma matrices, that entire expression is a scalar operator. And that thing, the Dirac operator, must have some nice expression in terms of differential form. And it does. It's simply the exterior derivative plus the co-derivative. How do we see that? Well, let's check. What happens if we square that? What happens if we square the Dirac operator? Anybody see that? What happens if we square the Dirac operator? If the Dirac operator is D plus del, what is it? Yeah, exactly. You see, the D squared term goes away. The del squared term goes away. So you get only the mixed terms, which are D del and del D. So D del plus del D. The anticommutator of the exterior derivative and the co-derivative. And that anticommutator is the Dalembertian, if you remember. So we've basically taken the square root of the D'Alembert operator. All right. If you want to read more about this, that is, I think it's page 78 or page 58 of Hocking and Ellis. All right. This is as far as we get today. And then we will continue with energy momentum tensors and then all of these things next time. Okay, see you Friday.